on our community as well as other interesting things in this one-hour show. On Wooden Spoons, we recognize that all things are related, and with learning and awareness, we connect the dots that make up our world. Every Friday morning on Wooden Spoons, we speak with guests on today's relevant issues, share nutritious recipes, and explore important topics with perspectives not found in the mainstream media. Time right now is 8 a.m. and the temperature outside is 10 degrees Celsius. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning, John. How are you this morning?
I am good. You?
Oh, pretty good. It was a very lovely morning. We had some rain last night, but it was very, you know, it's not cold.
It's not as cold as it looks outside, definitely. Like, it looks like it's honestly, it looks darker than usually does, but the weather outside's still pretty nice.
I know. It's just the shorter days and longer nights. You could see, certainly can be aware of that these days. Anyway, I just want to acknowledge Wooden Spoon. That we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Ojibwe-Cree, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. So this morning, just to give you some information about what we're going to be doing this morning. First of all, we have a guest who is a return guest who I will introduce very shortly. I also want to mention that next Friday, which would be, I think that would be October the 26th or so of next Friday anyway.
24th.
Mary Ann Sorelli and Kaylin Spain will be inaugurating their first program on Wooden Spoons. And so this will be interesting to listen to. And you'll be the co-host that morning.
Yeah, that's right. I'm still there.
Yeah. And so this morning we are going to be interviewing a former guest and a friend of mine, a longtime friend. And her name is Laura Steinman. And are you there, Laura?
Oh, I sure am.
Oh, good for
Great
you.
Great, really.
I was having these awful thoughts. I thought, oh, my God, would you remember how to use the information that you get on air? Because there's one is for the internet and one for just doing it differently. So, but you're very savvy. Anyway, I'm going to introduce Laura. She initiated and had been a co-host on she started Wooden Spoons and had been a co-host on Wooden Spoons for quite a few years before her move to Chilliwack, B.C., to join her late husband, Elder Art Shoffley. Laura was one of the founders of Mary Jane's Cooking School. And I got to know Laura through my association with a mentor, Wilhelmina House, who brought us together at the same time that Laura was attending the University of Winnipeg. And we have remained friends ever since and communicate with each other almost on a daily basis. So Laura continues to serve on the board of directors of Mary Jane's Cooking School, and she remains interested and involved in what is happening at the school. Laura went to the University of Manitoba, where she got her arts degree and later studied theology at the University of Winnipeg, where she got her master's degree. So today we'll be talking to Laura about what might seem as a mundane issue, but it is really a very important aspect of our lives, and that is of taking care of our living spaces and tending to the business at hand. So that's how I'm describing what our topic will be today. So welcome to Wooden Spoons, Laura.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
Okay, and you got up bright and early.
Pardon?
You got up bright and early.
Oh, yes, actually, mysteriously, my alarm clock went off at 4:56, and I know I didn't set it, so I think somebody came in from the spirit world and made sure that I didn't miss the time to get up for the show, and I'm happy to be here.
Oh, that's pretty neat. Yeah. Well, anyway, one of our board directors, Lynn, who you know very well, she asked me where you were born. And, you know, for some reason I don't think I know where you were born. But I was quite sure that you were probably born in Saskatchewan because you often spoke of your relatives being in that province. And then I noted that your father, or I recall, maybe hopefully correctly, that your father was a railway man and worked in different parts of the country, which necessitated several relocations. So maybe you could give us share some of the things about your own childhood and where were you born?
Okay, well, actually, I was born in Alberta. My father was with the Air Force at the time, and my mother was a nurse in Calgary. And they got married there, and I spent the first 10 years of my life in Alberta. My father left the Air Force, and he went back to the CPR, where he had apprenticed as a railway machinist. And so while he was working for the CPR, we lived in Red Deer, Calgary, Medicine Hat, and we finally left Alberta when I was 10 and went to Saskatchewan, where I lived for the next 8 years of my life. And then after that, it was all in Winnipeg, and it was... I identify very, very strongly with Saskatchewan because my grandparents were homesteaders there in the early 1900s, actually, about 1910. My grandfather started his homestead there, and my grandmother joined him very shortly after that. And so when I speak of Saskatchewan, it's because the years that I spent there were from the ages of 10 to 19, actually. They were the most important years in my life, in the way setting the way I was thinking and the values that I had, and I was so proud of my grandparents. And my grandfather especially was although he was Scottish, he was very, very close to the indigenous people who lived in the area around Gravelburg where he started his farm, because basically he was one of the only people around there. I mean, the Aboriginal people were there, and they were wonderful in helping him. But that when he started up, there weren't too many other people in his immediate area. So he had such good friends amongst the people there, the traditional people. And I don't know, somehow that love of Indigenous people and the culture spread to me, even though I wasn't there most of the time. I was doing other things, but his influence was really strong in me, and I really cherished the memory of him. Like my father-in-law, the mention of my grandfather's name or the thought about him immediately brings tears to my eyes, but it's really tears of gratitude. So, yes, but you know what? When I'm sitting here in Chilliwack, I turn my TV to the Winnipeg station through the opportunities that you have nowadays to look at different places. TV, and I'm always checking out what's happening in Winnipeg. So I guess my heart really now is right still there in Winnipeg, even though I'm living out here. So that's the story.
Well, that's a very interesting. And you know, you mentioned Gravelburg. Well, that rings a bell with me because I have a cousin. She's much older than me, but she's 94, and she was a Grey Nun. And she was stationed at Gravelburg.
Oh, yes, yes. It was about 6 miles from my grandparents' home. After they retired from their farm, they moved into a small town called La Flèche, which is very close to Gravelburg. La Flèche was named after the early priest out there, and Gravelburg was the big town that we went to when I went down to visit them, because they had more than one cafe there. That was the big deal.
Okay.
Hillberg is quite a wonderful Métis.
Quite recently, you have undertaken a job that is both time-consuming and thoughtful, and the work is of addressing the amazing amount of handmade jewelry and other items your late husband, Art Shoffley, has left. Do you want to tell us about the artwork that Art created and where it was kept?
Well, Art was always very artistic, and he wrote a lot of poetry and other things as well, and he liked to do carving. At one point, he originally came from Ontario, but he also traveled across the country, and part of his early years were spent up in Alaska, working as a longshoreman in that kind of area. He traveled a lot, but up there he learned carving from people, and he learned the great appreciation of the culture and the art of the North, especially around Alaska. So that was one part of his training around the arts. But afterwards, as an older person living here in BC, and earlier than that in Winnipeg, he got a lot of appreciation of the art of the prairie culture, and also of the West Coast culture down in BC. And so after he retired, he decided that he wanted to pay tribute to the different cultures of the area of the world, actually. He was very, very close to his own culture, to his own Aboriginal people, but he had a vision that encompassed a much wider realm, and he really appreciated people and cultures of all backgrounds. And so he decided he wanted to make pendants. He had seen on the prairies, especially in Saskatchewan, that the elders wore these pendants. They were things that they gathered from the natural world, mostly things like feathers or even bones, which they decorated with beads, and they would wear them. And he wanted to pay tribute to those elders, as well as to people of other backgrounds who would make jewelry. And so being attracted to all of the colors of the natural world, Art decided that he was going to buy beads and other items that came from other areas as well as his own background. And that his aim with his art was to bring people together, not to separate them. So when you look at his pendants, they have colorful beads. They have pendants, or I should say, the pendants part of the necklace had various decorations that were animals, symbols of different spiritual traditions. He just liked to bring everything together, and his aim was to make these pendants and to make them available to people. He wasn't really interested in selling them, but he did spend quite a bit of money purchasing the materials for them, and they were not expensive. He had a spirit as huge as his imagination, and so he'd go to thrift stores and other places and pick up these secondhand items that he would disassemble, and then he would put them into the pendants himself. And it was a wonderful experience for him to do that. At the same time, he was very ill. I mean, increasingly, his heart was failing him. And the ability to do this creative work was a great source of consolation and of joy to him. So it was his medicine as well as his passion.
That's beautiful.
So that was...
Yeah. I remember you gave me a pendant quite a while ago. I always wear it very often. It's with the different colors, the black, white, red... Yellow? No, not, I don't think it was
yes.
Black and red, white and red. Was mostly, anyway, I'll have to, and I wear, and it has a feather at the end, like a not a real feather, like a metallic feather. And it's such a neat little pendant. I really love it. So, and I remember you always referring to art as having been born in Batchewana Bay. And now, why would I remember that name? But that sticks with me.
Rhythm to it, I guess. But that was where art was born, that's true.
Ontario, right? Ontario, Batchewana Bay in Ontario?
Very near to Sault Ste. Marie, actually.
Oh, okay.
Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. He was like to call himself an East Indian because while we were in Winnipeg, he was definitely from the East as far as joking was concerned, and he loved humor, and it was one of the things that most people liked most about art as well.
That's true. He has a great sense of humor.
That you want to be.
Yeah, you're listening to CQW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons. We're talking to our guest Laura Steinman-Shoffley and our co-host John Dick. Do you have any comments to make, John?
Yeah, you said, like, in the beginning of the show that, like, art was into Inuit art. Okay, yeah, that's what you call it, Inuit art. Did he ever make any sculptures out of narwhal tooth or, like, walrus tusks? I know that some Inuit artists have done that. I've seen it at the Winnipeg Art Gallery.
Yes, I know he didn't do that. He was friends with Inuit people up in Alaska especially, but his main area of artistic activity there was the wood carving, actually, and he did some of that. He never did the soapstone or the other carvings, but he did really appreciate them.
Yeah.
Now, it's important to know that while living in Chilliwack, art was always involved with the Aboriginal people living there and their gathering place called the Longhouse. Would you explain this involvement and also the culture of the Aboriginal people living in Chilliwack? Because I understand that area is broken up into many small reservations instead of being one large area.
Yes, they are very... He always referred to the ones around here as postage stamp size. Not that they were, but over time, as there were more and more settlers, the land that allotted to the indigenous people was kind of pulled back, and they ended up with much smaller reserves. But Art was a member of the Salish Longhouse out here in Chilliwack and on the West Coast. The Salish Longhouse, and he was a member of it for 54 years, which meant that he kept coming here every year for 54 years to participate in their winter ceremonies, just even though he was working in other parts of the country, especially in Winnipeg. So the Salish Longhouse, the culture is extremely well formulated. It's very formal in lots of ways. It's very spiritually especially oriented. And he was a member of the Longhouse for 54 years. So the culture includes spirit dancing, going into the spirit in that sense. But there's a high emphasis around the value of sharing and of feasts and of the dances themselves and of family. So when here, people, and the season is divided so that each season has slightly different ceremonies. Each season is sacred. But especially the winter season is a time of gathering, and so as people do gather starting around this time, they participate in the sharing of their personal spirit. There's an initiation process that's involved in the Salish Longhouse that involves a period of sort of privation and of of separation. It's like a rebirth, and the initiates have chosen to do this. It's a bit grueling at first, but you do have a sponsor, people who's kind of are helping you at the same time. The culture is around the value of leaving your old self behind and of being reborn with a spirit that's guiding you. And it involves a new name and a new identity to a certain extent. And the membership in this longhouse, in which you have a name, a new name, and you are respected and loved and embraced by the other people in the longhouse. The longhouse is kind of like the little reserves themselves. For example, Art was initiated down in Washington State, because this culture extends along the coast. And so he has what they call sisters, people who are initiated at the same time, that are part, and for his entire life, these people were very, very special, like ordinary sisters or brothers to him. When one first comes to see these cultural events, when one comes from my background, which is Scottish and Irish Canadian, it's a bit shocking, because some of the dances and other activities in the longhouse ceremonies seem quite different. For example, there's a practice when they're bringing in the new participants, where the other people in the dance in the longhouse. There are a longhouse is a literal name for the gathering place. It's a long building, and in which the center of which traditionally there were fires that people would dance around those, and they would be dancing in their regalia, which was constructed by supporters and family members for them to reflect the identity that they were just gathering and just gaining at that point. It's like a naming ceremony in the process. So, there's so much to say. It's extraordinary. But the one thing that Art always emphasized to me was that although it may seem strange and foreign to us, the essence of the longhouse was the teaching of love. To him, being in the longhouse had everything to do with love and the value of love. And it was true that the participants had a strong sense of love for one another, and like familial love. So he loved coming here. He never missed a year from the time he was initiated at the age of about 27 or 28 until he died at 85. He loved to be here, and so it seemed natural that he would retire out here, especially since his son was living here at the time as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
yes,
that's
very extraordinary. It's a very somewhat different from the prairie culture, the spiritual ceremonies out there. But there's an awful lot of people from the prairies who come out here, and more and more of them are asking and seeking maybe to be initiated into the longhouse. So, yeah, I'm sorry to be so long-winded about it. There's just so much to say.
I know. Well, you know, and it's nice that you're describing it the way you are, because it's something that most people aren't familiar with, and I wasn't quite sure myself. What I knew it was a place for gathering and ceremonies, but you've made it much more clear. And how did you come to any decisions concerning the artwork and what eventually happened? Do you feel that you have been guided so that whatever had been done was meant to happen. So you,
yes,
you are involved with arts artwork in well, you could explain it.
Well, I've been very, very much involved until very recently, even most more involved, because we have just a small apartment here. And so when Art passed, there was still an awful lot of the materials for making his pendants and things piled up here in my living room. I've been living in a studio for the last few years. But Art made many, many pendants. And it was, as I said, it was a medicine for him while he was ill. But more than that, it was a passion because he wanted to bring people together. So one of his aims was to pay tribute to the missing and murdered Indigenous women, for example. He wanted to put together some pendants that might be able to be used to honor them and given to people from that community. When he passed, he had actually, I'd say, that more than 1,000 pendants, each one individually put together, and each one different. So as his wife and executress, I had the responsibility to take care of all these, all of his possessions like this and what to do with them. And I've been given an incredible support by people out here. It's unexpected and amazing, but so much appreciated. And I think part it was just meant to be. So I have been trying to ask to decide who to give or where to send pendants to, and I sent a number of things, rattles, which he also constructed with natural materials for the ceremonial purposes. So I had those, lots of those, as well as the pendants and a lot of his ceremonial drums as well. I have been sending them out to people whom Art cared about and loved, and you and your daughter, both of your daughters, Indira and Tanya, were people that Art was particularly fond of. So I sent some things to them and to yourself and other people in Winnipeg whom Art knew and who cared about Art. He worked for a long time in the justice system there, and his passion was in restorative justice. So a lot of the people in Winnipeg that I've sent some of these things to has something to do with restorative justice and the culture there. I still have some, a lot of items actually, but at the same time, I'm doing the thing that really meant so much to Art, and that is the giveaway. He really had no interest in selling things. Neither of us is very business inclined, I'm afraid. So, but he wanted to make sure that people who might appreciate them would be given some, would have the opportunity to either take these items at a giveaway, or would be given some of them. So, the giveaway is one of those very sacred ceremonies that's at the heart of the culture as well, and it has so much to do with the value of sharing, as above all, not materially gaining from things, but actually sharing them. So I've been giving a lot of things away, and people do appreciate them, especially in that spirit. Right now, I've been given a totally unexpected gift because another person who really appreciated Art through reputation was a retired RCMP officer out here in his family, who were members of another fellowship that Art was involved with. And these people have come in here and helped me to clear out so many of the things that were invading or maintaining residence in my little space here. It was time to get things moving. So Earl and Maureen have been coming here And with every passing year, I'm getting shorter. I think I'm a little bit less than 5 feet now. But Earl is gargantuan. He is so tall and so strong, and his wife is really energetic as well. So they have been packing up things for me and helping to send them to different other locations which would appreciate them, including some of the longhouses. So I've been getting lots and lots of unexpected help here to help finalize what I had to do with Art's things, and I'm so grateful. That's part of that culture of sharing.
That's a wonderful aspect of the culture for sure. And I know my daughter, Tanya, who lives in Calgary, she and her husband actually were both recipients of a number of Art's items, and they really appreciated it. And her husband, who was Croatian, was actually very delighted because he got a pendant, I believe, and also a jacket with beadwork on it. And I was surprised how he appreciated that. And I didn't think that he would have that sort of sensibility, but he did. And that was something that surprised me about her husband, Zvonimir. And my other daughter, she's a massage therapist, and she went to Cross Lake not that long ago to do some massages. Some Aboriginal woman, I believe, who invited her and drove there. And she was wearing the pendant that Art had given her, and everybody really took notice of that. And they were all very interested in that. So that was interesting, where the pendants are going and the influence that they're having on different people.
I think we always believe things happen when and where they're meant to be, and that would be very pleasing to Art, especially, to tell you the truth, of Vladimir's appreciation, because Art, as I said, he really wanted to. His target market were people of all backgrounds and cultures, and I have to say that the people from Germany and that part of Central Europe that Vladimir came from, they always were really attracted to anything to do with an indigenous culture. It was really interesting. So it's not surprising that Vladimir would be attracted to Aboriginal things. It's part of the culture from that part of the world as well. That the appreciation, especially of nature and of the forest and all that sort of thing. So thank you for sharing that with mm-hmm. me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that I wanted to let you know about that. And we mentioned that, well, I had made a suggestion of that you could sell the pendants and use the money to support any causes or to give to whatever helpful causes that you felt was necessary. And I recalled that I was encouraging you in that direction because I thought it was a respectful way of honoring the work Art had done, that it was actually had some monetary value. But instead, that's not what happened. And so Art never sold any of his pendants, as far as I know, when he was alive. Similar to Van Gogh, I don't think Van Gogh sold any of his paintings while he was alive. Do you want to comment on that? That the whole thing about the monetary not going, taking that route?
Well, out here when we were, when Art was alive, we did take some of his pendants to one of the craft shows, and people looked at them, and found them pretty. But out here, people have had time to develop a really refined culture, and so a lot of the West Coast jewelry involves much more expensive ingredients like silver and gold even, and a lot of carving, which was very time-consuming. So there was a lot of competition for the sale of jewelry out here at the two actual indigenous, especially craft shows that we did have a little display at. We just decided not to pursue that at the time. I was really encouraged by comments of some people that they were sure that these pendants would sell. But as I said, we weren't really so much interested in the monetary aspect. But he would have liked to have donated the pendants to nonprofit organizations that were supporting these causes, and to be a source of some support for them. And mysteriously or amazingly, or maybe meant to be, this retired RCMP officer who is helping me so much had a large part to do with working to investigate and support the relatives of the missing and murdered Indigenous women out here. So at that time, we didn't know him, but destiny sort of brought us together, and he's helping me so much with getting distributing arts pendants and other things now. So I don't know exactly where these will be going, but for nonprofit organizations that support the values like restorative justice or the Indigenous and missing and murdered women, those are the kinds of target markets that Art was hoping to donate these pendants for. And also he had a lot of appreciation for people who were musicians and other kinds of performers or artists who might be inclined to wear these pendants, because they are kind of, they're showy and they're unique, and they certainly do get a lot of attention. So whatever is meant to be will happen, and we really believe that.
Yeah, and I think Art is absolutely involved in the whole process, guiding the whole thing is going the way it was meant to go. It's become evident. And and now that you've made a great deal of progress with dealing with all the jewelry that was in your space, and it seems to have, has this opened up any avenues for you? Like, I have this memory, and I don't know where it came from, but I have this, I recall that there was a high shelf that you came across a diary or a book that you used for writing. It was up on top of a high shelf, and the book had fallen from the shelf, but it seemed to be triggering something to do writing. Does that ring a bell to you about a book on a high shelf that fell down? I don't know where that came from, but I remember you telling me that.
You mean here in Chilliwack?
Well, I'm not sure if it was... Well, this is it. I'm not sure of the time when that happened. Maybe it didn't even happen in Chilliwack.
Well, I'm actually... Art was quite a writer as well as everything else. And yes, I'm sitting... I'm right next to that high shelf. It's a high bookcase loaded with his books. It's the only thing that I haven't touched in the process of trying to... open up the space here and move out of the other crafts and things. So the shelf has a number of his things in it, including some of his writing. And actually, I think the time is coming now that the publication of his memoir might be coming close. He wrote a memoir, as you might remember, and
the RCMP officer
I'm referring to as well, he has written a 300-page memoir of a journey that he and some other people took down, a 1,000-mile journey, canoeing journey here on the coast. And I was just saying to him the other day that it's time to get that published, because it's incredible. I just got a copy of that manuscript. I thought maybe We might submit Art's manuscript along with Earl's to some publisher, because I think they would be of interest, especially to people who care about the indigenous culture and the experiences that people shared in this time. So we'll see what happens. But there's a lot of materials here that still have to be really explored and given their due.
Well, that's a really a very, very amazing what's happening, and I think it's all meant to be. And I think that Art's book is something that I had actually forgotten about it, but then as you're speaking, I remember that Art was working on this book. So this is another thing that is coming to be available, I'm sure. And I think in your own life, you are probably going to be doing different things yourself. Maybe you will be doing some writing as well. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it would be nice. It would be nice. One thing that really has come to my awareness is that although I spent a lot of time with the idea of being a writer and with writing, the really creative writer in my family was Art. I think when a person is naturally inclined to be creative, you cross over all different kinds of methods of expressing yourself, and so the creativity that's around me is just overwhelming, and hopefully it'll improve me. It'll help me to improve my own sensitivity to the beauty of the of creativity, and I might even draw something these days. But anyway, the important thing is, you mentioned Van Gogh and others. The value that was placed on their work came after they passed on, I know. Mm-hmm. And it can't be related to the cost of the canvas that they worked on, but the spirit that went into the art. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trusting that whatever is meant to be will be, and that value transcends the material, experience of it. So, it's wonderful. Every time I see a dime, I think of Art. It was some kind of spiritual experience that people were having that related to some spiritual visitation of a loved one in the spirit world. And so if you see a dime, Mary Jane and John, maybe you might think that Art is near you, because in my experience, he is. Dimes show up at the most unexpected but appropriate times.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind, I guess.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking, I think I might have run into some dimes lately. Well, thank you, Laura, for joining us. This has been certainly a very inspiring interview with you, and all these different things coming to blossom after Art's death. I think it's very exciting. And he definitely is, the whole thing is being guided spiritually from the other side. And just wonderful. So thank you again for joining us this morning.
It was my pleasure. I really appreciate it. Art loved Winnipeg, and he loved Mary Jane's Cooking School. He was the elder for that school.
He was, yes. I remember that. And I remember that when he had African students, and they were very, they called him uncle, which I didn't know was a term of endearment that was used in their culture. And they were black African men, and we were offering classes for them, I think because men were a kind of on their own in Canada, and it was not particularly honorable for men to be cooking, especially with women around. But anyway, Art was, they recognized Art as a leader, and they called him uncle, which is a form of endearment. So I always
honorific kind of title. Yes. I have to be honest, art wasn't the best cook, so that's, you know, not every art form is embraced by everybody, but he loved to cook anyway, so I guess he'll be taking cooking classes up there in the sky.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Lauren. I think we're going to be playing a song that you suggested. What was it, John?
Called In the Jailhouse Now, from the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which has a great soundtrack, by the way. I'll play it right now.
Ramblin' Bob, he used to steal, gamble, and rob. He thought he was the smartest guy around. Well, I found out last Monday that Bob got locked up Sunday. They've got him in the jailhouse way downtown. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. Well, I told him once or twice to stop playing cards and a shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
Howdy, old daddy,
to play his poker, a peanut, a whist, and yoker, but shooting dice was his favorite game. Well, he got thrown in jail with nobody to go his bail. The judge done said that he refused the fine. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. Well, I told him once or twice to stop playing cards and a shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now. Met a girl named Susie. I said I was the swellest guy around. Well, we started to spending my money, and she started to calling me honey. We took in every cabaret in town. We're in the jailhouse now. We're in the jailhouse now. Well, I told that judge right to his face, I don't like to see this place. We're in the jailhouse now.
Station ID.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons with Mary Jane Eason and John Dick.
I want to thank Laura, for joining us this morning. And also, as we listened to the song, reminding me that Art did work with the RCMP, and he worked in the prisons when he was in Winnipeg. So he was very, very involved in all those things. So that, I guess we're going to move on. We're getting close to the end of our program. I'm going to be just adding providing some information, nutrition information. I was going to provide some tips on making soups, perhaps. That might be a good place to start. And I have also wanted to include a recipe for fried green tomatoes, which is such a neat thing to make. Most people don't like green tomatoes. Have you ever tried green tomatoes, John?
I've just heard of the movie, which I haven't seen. I've never actually had green tomatoes.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, when you get all these tomatoes from the garden, so many of them are green, and you can slice them and dip them in maybe cornmeal. You could dip them in flour or dip them in cornmeal, and it'll stick with salt and pepper. And you fry them in a frying pan and turn them over, and they'll be brown on both sides. And they're very delicious that way. And I like trying green tomatoes. They're totally different from red tomatoes. So that just a simple recipe. And I have another recipe I can share. It's a Spanish omelette. And again, it serves four people and is very simple to make. You take three red potatoes thinly sliced and one medium onion peeled and thinly sliced, and 4 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 6 eggs, a half a teaspoon of thyme, and sea salt and pepper. I always like to say sea salt because if you get the sea salt, it is much healthier than the regular table salt, sodium chloride. Sea salt or Himalayan rock salt have all the complement of nutrients that are found in the sea, and in that way, I would consider it a whole food, and it is not harmful to your blood pressure or anything like that. So now you have your potatoes, and now you cook, sauté the potatoes in olive oil in a cast iron skillet until golden. Transfer to a bowl with a slotted spoon and sauté the onions. Meanwhile, beat the eggs with seasonings and return the potatoes to the pan. Combine with the onions and flatten to make an even layer and pour the egg mixture over the potatoes. You cook for about 5 minutes over medium heat, lifting the edge occasionally so the uncooked part can go underneath. You finish by placing the whole thing under a broiler for a minute or two, and then you cut in wedges and serve. So it's a very simple recipe using simple ingredients. A bit of information about the cabbage family. The cabbage family consists of strong-flavored vegetables, and they are also called cruciferous vegetables, named for their cross-shaped blossoms. And belonging to this family are cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, turnips, and rutabaga. These are all part of the cabbage family, and they are strong-tasting vegetables, but they're very healthy. They protect against cancer. But when you're cooking them, because they're strong flavored vegetables, you must keep the cover off to allow the strong flavors to escape. So I have a bit of information as we have some time left here about tips for making soups. Always save the water in which the vegetables were cooked, and you store the water in the refrigerator to make soups and gravies. The water has minerals and vitamins from the vegetables, and it adds flavor and nutrition to your soup. And each vegetable will have a different flavor. So not that long ago, we were cooking a lot of potatoes. I can't even remember what for. But anyways, we saved all the water, and I have it in the refrigerator for when we're doing soups. Another thing for flavor, you should sauté the vegetables and the herbs in the oil first, because all the flavorful compounds found in the herbs as well as the vegetables will dissolve in the oil and give flavor to the soup. The onions, carrots, celery, and garlic are considered aromatic vegetables that provide a lot of flavor. And speaking of having all this potato water at the school, that comes from when we were having our cooking class. We were cooking potatoes, and we had a big pot of potatoes, and we saved the water and poured them in jars. Once they cooled, you put them in the refrigerator. Now, dried herbs are useful in soups. There's dried parsley and basil, oregano or celery. These leaves are all very helpful in providing flavor. Fresh herbs can be added at the end of the cooking time for best flavor. Some fresh herbs, such as dill and basil, they lose their flavor if they are cooked too long. So you should put these at the very end of cooking. And the aromatic compounds found in fresh herbs can evaporate into the air. Potatoes added to soups can help thicken the soup. So if you want to thicken a soup, you can mash the potatoes and add it to the soup. That's just one way. Thyme gives body to the soup. It is a very grounding herb, and it also has a very strong flavor. Lemon and thyme go well together. And cumin is another spice that is a very a grounding spice. Have you ever used cumin or tasted cumin, John?
I don't really cook much with cumin, no. I usually, my soup usually has nutmeg and pepper in it.
Okay. Nutmeg and pepper, that's an interesting combination.
Yeah, it's for mushroom soup.
Okay. That's nice to know. Nutmeg and pepper. So lemon and thyme go well together, and cumin is a very grounding spice. So it kind of gives body to the soup. I'm not sure how you describe grounding, but it's something that is sort of calming. And lemon juice pairs well with cumin. Now, salt is always needed for flavor. And use an unrefined salt that has trace minerals. It is then beneficial to your health. And for example, as I mentioned earlier, Himalayan rock salt provides trace minerals. And if the soup lacks flavor, it is likely because it needs salt. That seems to just sort of corrects any flavor imbalance for some reason. However, people have different sensitivities to salt, and that is an individual thing. And I know there's some people that I have one person in our class that does not use salt at all. So what may seem salty to one person may not be salty to another. So that's why a recipe always states, you know, makes a statement of adjust seasonings to your taste. So if your soup happens to be too salty, just add lemon juice to counter the saltiness. You can also add some potatoes, which absorbs the extra salt. Conversely, if there is too much lemon flavor in your soup, then you add salt. Add tomatoes toward the end of the cooking time, since tomatoes will toughen vegetables and they will take longer to cook. When cooking, strong flavored vegetables such as cabbage and broccoli, cauliflower, turnip, as I mentioned earlier, you should keep the cover off to allow the strong flavors to escape. Otherwise, you're going to get a very unpleasant flavor in your soup. It could be unpleasant because it's quite strong. So I think on this note, we have completed our program on wooden spoons, and
you have been listening to Wooden Spoons, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM. For our podcast, please go to ckuw.ca, type Wooden Spoons in the search bar, and the show will be up in just a few hours. Till next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.